No.
So he asked what Steve Horowitz has against Jordan Peterson. Yeah, what's his beef?
I can't hear myself in my headphones.
You can't?
Yeah, let's fix that first.
Can you hear me?
Like, it's very faint. You just need to turn me up.
No.
Huh. I can't do that. Unless there's a separate control. Anyway, so Steve Horowitz, it's kind of just a...
Do you plan to cover it during the thing?
No. Well, not really. I mean, okay. he looks at everything from an economic point of view, mm-hmm. and what's best for economies, mm-hmm. In his own personal mindset, this traditional point of view of philosophy versus postmodernism is not capable of achieving his ideal goals.
Okay,
so that. I mean, that's his basic, I mean, fundamentally, that's what it is.
Does he have a rant someplace?
Yeah, well, a little bit.
Boss Hog of Liberty.
Yep.
It's been a show.
Yeah.
For real.
I just, since Matt's not going to wear headphones, I just gave you his.
Yeah.
Oh, so, okay.
I don't need headphones. Is there a reason I should have them?
No. I don't
I'm not as cool as you guys.
I don't get any of that, but I was half paying attention because I was fixing the problem, but
I don't much get it either.
He's never really articulated in a satisfactory way in my mind.
No, it's all...
Because, I mean, generally I like Horowitz, so...
Yeah, me too. See, that was that's why I really wanted him to come on the show I've watched his Learn Liberty videos since I first became interested in libertarianism, so it was like a really cool thing to have him come on, and I was really, really surprised to learn that he didn't like Peterson. He views his ideas as unoriginal, which is true. I mean, they are unoriginal in a sense because
name me an idea that's original in 2018.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
Like here's the thing about it. We were talking in the bonus episode that will be right before this about the building blocks of you're standing on each other's shoulders and you're building on top of what everybody else is building. Like Peterson, I just don't read a lot of new groundbreaking concepts.
Yeah. You don't get groundbreaking concepts. And I think that he even recognizes that because it's... Everything he's talking about are very old ideas,
mm-hmm.
that are just being looked at in a 21st century perspective, and how these old ideas can help the situation in which we find ourselves, and that's
Lord.
Of course you're going to have unoriginal ideas, mm-hmm. but that's I don't think that is a healthy criticism of another person's ideas or intellect.
I totally agree with you.
Whenever he came on to the show, I was really hoping that he would elaborate a lot more,
mm-hmm.
and he didn't have that much to say. He said that in the fields that he is an expert in, Peterson is wrong, but didn't really elaborate the fields that he's an expert
which
in.
Which is sort of what he says. That's what a lot of people say. Like, the whole thing about, anti-Peterson talk is just that it's... I don't like that he's famous.
Yeah,
I'm jealous.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Not necessarily saying that about Steve Horowitz, but I'm saying, like, when you read, like, the Matt Welches of the world, it's like, they aren't in our club. They're not allowed to be famous if they're not in our club. You know, that's sort of how
exactly.
it feels.
So mm-hmm. Whenever I first started seeing Steve put out criticisms about Jordan Peterson, I originally believed, that this was just because of a jealousy thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, Steve has put a lot of his time and effort into trying to educate people and trying to introduce ideas in his field that are the best. And then he hasn't become a millionaire overnight.
Well, yeah.
In the same sense. So I thought it might be jealousy. But after talking to him and having him on the show, I really don't think it's jealousy.
I wish he would have elaborated a little more on that episode, because I am genuinely curious, and I'd love to see, and I've asked him this on my, when he's criticized Peterson on my Facebook page, mm-hmm. I'm like, can you give me, like, an explanation, like, or yeah. links or something, and I just never get it, so,
mm-hmm. right,
but, you know, any, so anyways, so kind of what I want to do here tonight is I want to give people an idea of how to develop their own personal moral system. Like I want to talk about Peterson first, and I want to talk about that experience, and I want to talk about how crazy it is that 2,500 people showed up to hear some dude lecture about what he lectured about, and we'll recap that and talk about the crowd and who's attracted to him. But then I also kind of want to have a discussion of how did you guys develop your own personal value system? How do people figure out what they believe? And why is that important? You know, like I think the immigration thing, for instance, is important because it's to me like I'll say this on the air. But anyways, so
now we're gonna get deep. We're gonna get deep in this one.
Yeah. Well,
you should tell me that
we're gonna be on a mission for Christianity tonight.
We're gonna have a 45-minute lecture. I'm gonna give my first homily.
Because you're Christian too, right?
Yeah.
It's I wish you would have told me that we were going to be talking about morals. I would have reread the On the Genealogy of Morality by Nietzsche before I came.
Oh yeah, just you know, quick.
Well, that's three essays. Basically, the first one is the most difficult to grasp. The second one is kind of you can just skim through it and get the basic idea. And then the third one is just a good read.
All right, I will.
Yeah, I think
I'll Wikipedia it here real quick.
All right. Here we go. Actually, you two talk amongst yourselves. I'm going to take some Robitussin.
Some Robitussin.
Whoa!
I'm going to get high on the purple drink.
Man, I feel like codeine.
I feel good.
Yeah.
I feel good, it's just when I podcast that I still have symptoms.
Man, I've been fighting this horrible, I don't know what it is, chest cold, head cold, or something for like the past 4 weeks.
Yes. And it's a fever that's going around.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm. It seems like it like ebbs and flows because at some points it seems like it's getting much better and it's improving. And then the next day I'll wake up and I will just have a horrible cough and a sore throat.
Is that Nietzsche?
Yeah, that's what he was saying. He was just going to...
That's what we're getting into tonight.
I'm just going to read it a little bit before...
All right, let's get that out of the way.
Hold on. Let's go back to the sickness. So, yeah, my mom is a nurse and she said that everybody's got this like month-long... You have like an instance, you have the flu in the beginning, and then it just lasts forever.
Yeah, that's exactly how it was. I felt like I almost took a day off of work, but I don't get paid for sick days. So I was that guy that came into work sick.
Oh, you bitch.
But my coworker was already sick because I think he gave it to me. So
I had to take the day off. I never take the day off, but I had to. And I laid in bed and watched Cars 3. I'm man enough to admit I cried at Cars 3. I teared up.
I haven't seen Cars 3.
It was good.
Did you tear up at Toy Story 3?
Oh, are you kidding me? Yeah.
Jeez, come on.
Yeah. You're not a human if you didn't tear up.
I'm sorry, but what was the when the Hudson Hornet was in his glory days and it just was very
tough. Oh, I have seen that.
Yes.
Yeah, now that you're talking about it.
Basically, yeah. Lightning McQueen goes out of the race and lets the girl race car in.
Mm-hmm.
Because men can't have anything anymore.
No, it's been feminized.
A girl race car driver, stop.
We don't even have Danica Patrick anymore.
I'm basically just trying to trigger one person. I shouldn't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. All right, here we go. Or not. What's happening?
False start.
There we go. Thank you. Welcome to We Are Libertarians. I'm your host, Chris Spangle. We bring you all of the irreverence modern politics deserves while putting people before political parties. We examine current events from a libertarian perspective with the goal of leaving you better informed. Please be sure to rate and review us on iTunes, like us on Facebook, and subscribe on Patreon. In exchange for supporting our program, we give you all kinds of bonus content and free stuff. Please be warned that this show is raw, unedited, and authentic, so the language is sometimes strong and offensive. If you want to reach us, editor@wearelibertarians.com. My name is Chris Spangle. I am joined by Matt Whitliff. Matt,
hello.
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Nice to see you again. We just recorded a... we freaked Dakota Davis out.
Yeah.
Dakota from the Boss Hog of Liberty is here. How are you?
I'm doing really good, Chris. How are you?
Good. Oh, well, that was abrupt.
Oh, man.
I'll never be good at that. I was never good at it at WXNT. I won't be good at it now. So, Matt showed up about an hour and a half before Dakota, and we recorded a bonus episode called Defined. And basically what we're doing is we're doing a series basically defining politics. And so part of the issue is that I feel that we don't work off of the same vocabulary. So sometimes we're arguing on Facebook or in person or in the media, things with different definitions. And so what I want to do is go through and define a lot of different things. And so we're working on the definition of libertarianism and how it came about and what is our intellectual heritage. And then we're going to do conservatives and progressives. And we may eventually release that to the public, but for now we're just doing kind of a rough draft of the series in the bonus portion of the show. So if you're a $5 a month subscriber on Patreon or above, then you can have access to that today. You go and sign up, you can get it today because it's already in there, and you can hear an hour-long discussion between Matt and I talking about the intellectual heritage of the of libertarian thought. And that is exclusive only to our Patreon subscribers. You don't want to miss it. And then in addition to that, if you're a $5 a month subscriber, you get we recorded 10 minutes of show before we started. So you get the bonus content there. You get no commercials. You get CD quality audio, stereo, 128 kilobits per second. It sounds so good. And not like if you're on the main feed, that's 96 or 64.
My gosh.
Gross. So 64 when I get real long-winded and we do a three-hour show, but I try to make it high quality for you people. You know, and if you're at $10 a month, then you get access to our private Facebook group where we like to make fun of the people on the other Facebook group that you can find at WeLibertarians.com. You can watch the live stream of the show. You can participate in the chat. When we do the live show, $25 a month, you get a poster, which I desperately need to mail to some of you. I sincerely apologize. I have had them in my trunk for about 2 weeks now, and I just have not gone yet to mail those out. But they are coming, I promise. And then $100 a month, you get exclusive access to me. You get to come on the show. You get to be a part of it. And we've got four of those folks, Brandon Luke, Craig DaCosta, Jason Doolittle, and Christy Avery. Thank you for being thank you for that level of support. It's awesome. And we're going to have Jason on the show soon. So very excited to have him fly. He's flying in from Texas.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
And so he's going to spend a couple days with us. So very exciting for that. Those are the class announcements. Other than getting the show notes, if you want links, you know, tomorrow night we're going to do an episode about the immigration stuff, and I'm going to have like 100 links, and I'll send that to your email box. If you sign up at WeAreLibertarians.com, you'll get those in your email box every show. Dakota, I don't know if you heard the end of the last show, but I was just praising Boss Hog of Liberty.
On the last show.
Your podcast. Yeah. I was just telling everybody what a great podcast you have.
I did listen to that. I was very pleased.
Is there anything you'd like to say to me?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yes. No.
Please add Dear Leader at the end of that.
Yes. Yeah. No, Boss Hog of Liberty is a great show. Here's the reason why I praised it, if you did not hear it. What Boss Hog of Liberty has done is they've basically created the media outlet for their hometown, their home county, and that is like the go-to for information about local politics, culture, history, just doing a podcast.
We have a variety of people on. It's not just politics or any kind of policy per se, but it's all about just localities. Like Henry County is where we're in. I live in Newcastle, Indiana, in Henry County, which is the main city in there.
Right.
And we started out, it was strictly political, and then we started kind of branching off into other areas, and it ended up being a pretty good show. People like the different things that we do. Obviously, people stick around for the politics of the county, and we have listeners that are all over the country, because it might focus on our community and our county, but we realize that everybody in the country has got a county like ours, and they are all experiencing similar issues.
Yeah, so even if you don't live in the county, check it out. It's a great show, and we want to eventually roll this model out to other counties.
It's a great model.
And help you set up your podcast so you become – I think you've really shown your community that libertarians can lead. They aren't weird.
Yeah.
They're not just a bunch of pot-smoking creeps. Like,
yeah. I think you should just promise to send Dakota Davis to whatever county.
Well, he's very handsome.
You know, that wants to have him.
He's the
My own county doesn't want me.
Right. No. They don't want you by association. They're trying to get rid of Jeremiah.
They're trying to get rid of the boss.
Is that right? Yeah. How funny is it, Dakota, that I jokingly call him the Boss Hog of Liberty because he's bossy,
mm-hmm.
and then it ends up becoming a revered podcast in Henry County. What a great troll.
It is. It's the greatest troll that I've ever heard of. I've ever experienced in my lifetime. It's hilarious. I keep thinking, like, should we change this to something like Local Liberty or something like that? Like, come up with a name that makes more sense to people? And I'm like, I just can't do that.
You can't.
It's hilarious.
It's because people hear that and go, what?
Yeah.
Like, I know what I'm doing. Trust me. He said, I want to do a podcast. And I said, I will give you a podcast, but you have to take this name. And he was very, go back and listen to the beginning of episode one. He was not accepting
his fate.
He was not.
Yeah.
Actually, let's not go back and listen to episode one.
Now, I need you, if you want to help troll Jeremiah, all I need you to do is go to Jeremiah Morrill's Facebook page and comment, what is your opinion on wind farms?
And the Doughboy.
Or where do you think we should move the Doughboy? Just all you need to know is, what is your opinion on wind farms? And that trust me, you will irritate him enough to at least, I'll get at least two angry messages from him. But
at least two. And he will probably get more messages from people, because he's running for county council.
Right.
So he's probably going to get more people who are possible constituents that are legitimately curious about the wind farms and moving the Doughboy.
So maybe not the wind farms, but the Doughboy. The Doughboy, to me, like this statue in Henry County that is being moved from one section of the park that's back in a secluded wooded area to a place of prominence with its own museum, and the boomers in this town have lost their mind. Like,
yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, they've gone to the Memorial Park and Henry County Park Board meetings and legitimately protested, brought in signs that said hashtag don't move the Doughboy, hashtag we the people for some reason. But it was it's a really big deal. But it's all sensationalized because of a generational thing, because these people have relatives who might have actually been Doughboys.
Right. So they don't know for sure, but they might have been Doughboys.
Right.
So they're very motivated. Yeah. What about, my favorite is, what about the War Mothers?
Yeah.
And I just want to go.
Yeah, that's my favorite too.
How many women who were born in 1843 are still alive? And they never can answer that question.
Well, there's one remaining War Mother.
From World War One.
Well, I don't know if she's from World War One, but she's quite elderly. And she is, she's not even from the state.
She's like,
and she came down to Henry County to protest at one of the meetings.
The wife of the mother of some Vietnam veteran, and she's, you know,
probably, yeah.
So not World War One.
I have mixed feelings about the Doughboy because I can see it from both sides.
Oh, you fence sitting. Come on.
But I will say that
I need an answer from you. I'm disappointed in you.
You want because, an answer? I've given this answer so many times, Chris.
No. Let me explain to you how this works. Okay, I constantly am having to explain to Jeremiah and Dakota how broadcasting works.
Yeah,
you have to take
it really is.
You have to take a hard line and be confident in that opinion and create controversy, and then people react to that controversy with their own opinions, and discussion ensues, and you get attention that way. But these two, you go on and you listen to their Doughboy podcast, and I'm like, I don't know, I guess I could see it from both sides. Like, nobody's, that's not interesting. That's not interesting. I need right now, Dakota Davis, should we move the Doughboy, yes or no?
Be well, a man. Take a stand.
Here's the thing.
Oh, boy.
No
definitive statement has ever started with, Here's the thing.
Here's the thing, though.
It's like, where do you work?
What would Jordan Peterson say?
Right. Where do you work? Well, right now, that means they hate their job. Yeah.
Well, in regards to the Doughboy, obviously one of the main issues surrounding the controversy, it's going to take like $30,000 to get a new statue, because the people who do not want this move are bringing proposals to the park board and saying, here, let's get a new statue and put it in front of your new museum.
Two Doughboys.
Yeah, that was one of the proposals, was let's buy a separate Doughboy. $30,000. And in our county council races, it has become an issue of, would you vote on funding a new Doughboy? $30,000, which is preposterous. I mean, that's the dumbest idea I've ever heard. But I can see, if I'm using a logical side of me, I say
it's a long way to get to a yes or no.
If I'm using the logical side of myself, then I say yes, move the Doughboy, because it could possibly attract people to the county and it could be a very good thing. But I can understand the emotions that surround it.
You going to see a Doughboy? You driving in the hour to go see the Doughboy, Matt?
Not Newcastle.
Right. I'm more attracted to your Buffalo Wild Wings than I am your Doughboy, to be honest.
I mean, not once that brand new museum is put up.
Well,
after the museum, we have to have the museum.
And how much are you spending on the museum?
I don't know the logistics. That we do know that Jeremiah Morrill was on the park board, was the president of the park board whenever this came into play. And so apparently it must not have cost too much money.
I imagine more than $30,000.
I would think so as well. But it's all been done, like the vast majority of it has been done by private donations. A trucking company has done all of the transportation for the statue, getting it refurbished. It's all been paid for pretty much privately.
Yeah. No, it's just the most insane boomer bull ass I've ever heard in my life. I don't even want to talk about it anymore. I'm mad and nobody cares anyways, because it's a World War I statue. If it were Saving Private Ryan and it was a statue of Tom Hanks, then everybody would.
But see, it's like it's one of the only one left in the United States that's in its original.
Yeah, because nobody wants them.
They've all been moved.
Nobody cares. Like, tear it down. Put a Robert E. Lee statue up instead. That's at least fun.
That's what we talked about last time I was here.
Right.
Let's not get into it again.
Yeah. Like, oh, and see, that's controversy. People, how dare he say that it doesn't matter? How dare you defy our history? Yeah, you're old. Shut up. No one cares. Put up a statue of a kid that died from Newcastle in Afghanistan. That's something that's...
Yeah, that's what I would like to see happen. Yeah. I would like to see us create a different memorial, obviously, for something that's happened recently. We don't even have a Vietnam memorial in our park.
Yeah. Well, we should spend a lot of money on that. That's a state. These statues, I swear. We have one in Plainfield where I grew up. They spent like tens of thousands of dollars on a statue devoted to the family. And in one of the parks, it's just like, it's like a little Toto dog and a dad and a mom and a couple kids, and it's just clearly like white people and a boy and a girl, and they're all cute, and you know, and it's just like, all right, that's not necessarily the makeup of the average family in Plainfield. The dad statue's way over in Swinford Park, not in Friendship Gardens, and he's hooking up with a 19-year-old hooker. That's more along the lines of the traditional family of Plainfield where I'm from, but so, speaking of traditional values, that's what we're going to talk about tonight. As I said, Dakota and I went and saw Jordan Peterson on Friday, and we want to break that down a little bit, and then also walk you through how do you decide what you believe, because I think it's incredibly important. For instance, the immigration debate that's happening right now. It's not, to me, about whether or not you think... Jeremiah is distracting me, trying to insert
that's what
him
he does.
And trying to insert himself into the conversation when he was not invited in the first place. Just like Dakota, I was not invited to his to be in his wedding. Who introduced him and his future wife?
Oh, you did.
That's right. Was I invited to the bachelor party?
Nope.
I sure wasn't.
Which you would not have gone to that bachelor
party. I wouldn't have had fun. He's a real friend because he looked at me and he goes, I don't know if you're actually hurt or not, but I'm going to tell you, you don't want to spend a weekend with drunk people. Oh, yeah, you're right. You're a great friend. Yeah, really, thank you.
Go back and listen to the post-bachelor party episode of Boss Hog.
Yeah, where I'm just giving... I felt bad because I was like just genuinely teasing him, but I can see how people are like, oh, what a dick. But again, controversy, people. Come on. So, like, you look at the immigration debate, and regardless of whether you're open borders or closed borders, do you think weaponizing childhood trauma is good or bad? That's the question on the table. And do you think that how do you view human beings?
I'd like to weigh in and say I'm against that.
Right. Yeah. And so I think everything breaks down to these debates breaks down into two camps. It is people who are beholden to their political party, their political ideology, some abstraction, or it is people who are putting people first. And how do you get to that place? Because I think you can look at, it's a very leftist sounding thing, like I'm putting people first, but that's...
I think you could equally say you're putting your own values first. Right?
That's exactly right. I think if when I look at this, I'm first informed by my value of empathy and that government should function in a way that I would want individuals to interact with each other. And so how do you break that down? How do you decide what you believe? How do you apply that to politics? And that's what we're going to talk about in the second half. But first, Jordan Peterson came to town. He's on a book tour. And he was sold out in Atlanta. I had a friend who bought scalper tickets to Jordan Peterson, which is hilarious.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Scalper tickets to see a man given a 75-minute lecture.
He literally stood on stage. So it was at the local theater. And
The
Murat, okay. Yes. And so it's a 2,500-seat theater. It was packed. It was full. Dakota and I paid the same price for tickets. You were where?
I was six rows from the stage.
I was two rows back from the door. And
in row pee-pee.
Yeah. I was like, thank you for that joke, because I basically posted, Jordan Peterson's teaching everyone to grow up, and all I can think about is how I'm sitting in pee-pee.
We have my wife to thank for that one.
Yeah. So I walk into the theater, and I start looking for my seat, and you think, okay, I'm going to look for a row pee-pee. And it's going to take me like 20 rows, and I'll be up in good seats. And then I walk, I turn the corner, I look down, I'm like, aw, shit. Now you claim that you had some Boss Hog connection to get those tickets.
Yeah, there wasn't any Boss Hog connection.
Okay.
It was just I happened to follow the Murat on Facebook.
Right.
And they were like, pre-sale coming. And for Jordan Peterson, 12 Rules for Life. So I just set an alarm on my phone. I sent you the link beforehand. I put it in the group chat.
I didn't have the $60 that morning, or else I would have gotten it. But so I just got it when I got paid, and then I got sat in the back. And listen, people don't know how to act in public anymore.
Mm-mm.
All right, they don't. They have no concept of how to be a person in society because everybody is just dumb and selfish. Now I'm not dumb, okay? But when you go to a performance, you were not to pee. You were not to get up and go get a drink because you're bored.
I have been cursed with a comically small bladder, and I didn't get up to pee during that.
Yes, I got reamed when I posted this on Facebook by some girl that I don't even know. Like, I have a condition. I'm not talking about you.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the jackass who halfway through when he got bored, like I got bored, well, I better go drain the old lizard and get a beer. It's not a Colts game, jackass. There's no halftime. Like, the reason the Murat Theater seats are so long is because you don't get up in the middle of a performance, even in the middle of a talk like that. There's a guy on stage who is watching commotion out in the seats, and it's thrown by that. And the 15 people you made stand up to go pee all were annoyed. Like, there, I have never been to, I bet 10% of that crowd got up and went to the bathroom.
It was constant. It didn't stop.
A 20, 20, 200 people, easy. There's not even a doubt in my mind that it was 200 people.
It's an old theater. Right? Yeah, so no, the seats squeak.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So it was squeaking, and I'm like right by the door, and so the light's shining in. Like, I could barely concentrate. Yep. And that's the point, is when you go to a performance, a comedy performance, you don't text on your phone. You don't talk. You don't go to the bathroom. You know, it's like, performers on stage need to concentrate. The audience needs to concentrate. If you go to a play, if you go to a classical performance, you're supposed to immerse yourself in what is being performed live in front of you. It's not a sporting event.
So I don't want to disrupt your flow too much, but this is one of the questions I had.
Okay.
So I think it's an opportune time. So what was the makeup? I was really curious, right, when you guys told me hey, we're going to talk about this. We went to the show. And I've listened to a little bit of Jordan Peterson, not a lot, right? I'm very curious to hear what the composition of the audience was.
So speaking of Colts games, what was it up in your hoity-toity seats? What was
I had, right behind me were two young teenagers who were probably 16 and 17. Like, this was for some reason, their parents let them get out of the house and go to Jordan Peterson. Their parents probably bought them the tickets. And during the entire beginning, they just kept talking. They were really nerdy, and I was just getting very annoyed by
them.
No
social norms whatsoever. Yeah.
At one point, one of the kids goes, "Everybody asks what's the meaning of life, but nobody ever asks how is the meaning of life."
What?
And I said, "That doesn't even make sense." Like,
did you just like look over at your wife and start laughing?
Yeah, we did. Yeah. And the dude beside him, his friend, is like, "Yeah, man."
Right. You remember being 15.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So that was hilarious. But surprisingly, there were quite a bit more women there than what I expected.
Okay.
Which I don't know why that was surprising, because I know a lot of women who are fans of Jordan, including my wife. And
Jeremiah was like, "This is like fish in a barrel. You're going to get 5 co-hosts and a date for every night of the week." I'm like, every girl here is with a guy. Every female there was there because her husband got tickets, or like, it wasn't. There weren't a lot of single females there. Trust me, I was
all the single ladies.
I was
there,
looking. Huh? I was like, if you're at a Jordan,
on the prowl,
if you're at the Jordan Peterson by yourself, young lady, we're going to go out. But me and about 1,000 other guys had probably the same thought.
Yeah.
It looked a lot like a Libertarian convention meets a Trump rally. So when we went to the Trump rally at the state fair, I was amazed at how many, you know, like, you're a Gen X, you know.
I am Gen X.
Gen X, you live on the north side of town, you have a nice house, you're not the type of guy that I would think would go to a Trump rally. You have all your teeth, you know, no mullet, and
no hair.
It was a lot of upper middle class guys at the Trump rally, and that was the same. There were a lot of guys there who, you know, were middle. It was almost all young guys. It was almost all guys under 35. Mm-hmm.
I saw a lot of father son duos in my area.
Interesting.
And it was guys dressed nicely, but I also saw a lot of guys like who looked like James Weeks and had like crazy bushy hair and like hadn't showered. It was a very smelly crowd. if they didn't have BO, then they had on too much cologne. So yeah.
There were no smells in the front row.
Oh, it was brutal in the back. It was bad.
It was bad in pee pee.
It was bad. It was bad in the pee pee seats. I smelled. The girl next to me, she was married to a guy. She had her purse on her lap the whole time, didn't make a noise. She just sat there like a prisoner. She clearly, and this poor guy, I remember being married, and you know what this is like, both of you being married. He's like the whole time kind of leaning over, trying to get her into it. Like, trying to give her a little context, or like, "Haha, isn't that funny?" Or like, because she's clearly not having a good time, and he's like bummed that she's not having a good time. So like, she can't help but like do something nice for her man, because it's all about her. And so he's trying to reassure her the whole time. And I just was like, I just wanted to look at her and go, "You're the type of lobster I want to send to Red Lobster." I had a couple bros in front of me who, you know, cargo shorts, clearly go to the gym a lot, you know, like in the back, there were a lot of people yelling, "Woo!" you know, like,
yeah,
making
yeah.
it about them,
yeah,
like the shouting things, because, you know, and when he'd mention something, they'd all start clapping. Here's the a lot of suspenders.
We were clapping. Audrey and I were clapping.
Right, a lot of suspenders too.
Suspenders
and bow ties.
I did see a lot of bow ties.
A lot of
Jeffrey
Tuckers there.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the thing. I love Jordan Peterson, but I kind of got a lot of the articles based on the crowd, and I don't know if you feel this way, but.
No, I totally get it. Like, I left there with a whole new perspective.
Yes. Mm. Like, I got the impression from the crowd that if Jordan Peterson told these guys to do something, they would do it.
Yeah. Yep.
It's a very cult-like atmosphere.
So, and that's kind of something that I thought about beforehand because of all the hit pieces that have come out on Peterson, is I'm not sure who is worse, the people who are putting out the hit pieces that are making baseless claims or taking his... words out of context, or the diehard fans that obviously have no idea what his words actually mean and are commenting in the comments section.
I had one, and I think he was kidding, and I called him on it because you can't say stuff. Grant Henley in the group chat says, "Leave mullets alone. I've been growing mine for 4 months, and I'm getting married with a majestic mullet next year."
Nice. Good for you.
Grant... What are you doing? We'll get to you later, but that's funny. send pics of your sweet mullet. Post them in the Facebook group. So I did. I'm just like you. I kind of went, this is a little creepy. It reminded me of the Ron Paul crowd, where if you said anything, like I had one friend who posted on Facebook that he was at the event and he wrote, "Long live the patriarchy." Yeah, and I replied back to it because if you say that kind of stuff, what you're doing is just feeding into, I get the shitposting aspect of that, but like the normies out there kind of just buy into whatever the press is. Like, you need to fight the narrative around this because what Peterson is actually talking about is self-help.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, you know, he's talking about values.
He
first.
Says it constantly that his message is not geared towards men, it's geared towards people. And it just so happens that men resonate, like it resonates with men more often than it does with women.
And I find that stuff really unhelpful, and I felt there were a lot of guys there who have that Trumpian attitude of, mm-hmm. I'm going, you know, it's that false alpha male, like, here's, and maybe this is where we can start because it dovetails into that. Part of what I like about Peterson is that he's the complete juxtaposition of Donald Trump.
Oh, my God.
He's the total opposite.
Yeah.
He is a... Jordan Peterson, and you watched it, he's a sensitive man. There's something effeminate about him, mm-hmm. in a way.
Well, like, he talks like Kermit the Frog. Right? So
he's very... and I identify with this in some ways. Like, I think when you're a Christian, especially a Christian male... Gentleness, patience, meekness, these are virtues in the Christian world. And so you try to be more like Christ and be empathetic and patient and loving. And I think Jordan Peterson, in a lifetime of being a Christian, has all those traits. And so here's a man on stage who's humble, who's kind of shocked by his success. He's completely, his mind is as blown as ours that he's got 2,500 people showing up to watch him talk about,
perception like, versus reality.
Perception versus reality and scientific studies and philosophy. And, you know, and then in the second part, you know, what's your aim in life and how do you achieve your goals? And then at the end, he did Freebird and like talked about the nature of religion and then did the Q&A, which I thought was the best part.
I love the Q&A.
That was the best part. And so he has a lot of the, like, what the Bible outlines as the fruit of the Spirit, all of which are the complete opposite of Donald Trump's version of masculinity.
Yeah.
Donald Trump is arrogant. He is loud. He is emotionally weak. He is sensitive. He is prickly. He is quick to anger. He is, there's just... He's impulsive. Like, he's the exact opposite of Jordan Peterson. And yet there are so many men in that crowd who, in my mind, and maybe I'm judging a book by the cover, but you tell me if I'm wrong, that seemed like they were there to support Donald Trump's version of masculinity.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's, I would say that well over half of the people there go there and they don't actually hear or think about what Peterson's right. saying. They have no idea. I don't know if it's because they don't think about it. They hear somebody who's saying big words and then they read the hit pieces and think, yeah, he's on my side.
He's countercultural and I'm countercultural and yeah. he's owning the yeah. libs and I'm for it. I'm here because I want to check in and show my friends that I don't buy into the liberal agenda.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I got that vibe from well over half of the people there. And then the other half were people who were legitimate, like the father-son duos. You could tell, like, you could tell that it was probably the father had at one point in time showed the son and been like, hey, this guy's really neat. And then they struck up a bond over that because you can tell the difference in the audience members because they're the people who are actually listening and trying to figure it out. I mean, I don't know how you were, but I mean, I was captivated that entire time because I was trying to understand. I mean,
you can't casually listen to Jordan Peterson.
No. It's not.
I mean, in the talks that I've heard, right? I mean, he is an intellectual.
You
have to pay attention to keep up. So I don't know if he dumbs it down in an audience like this.
In my mind, it was more difficult than most of his YouTube lectures that is in his podcast feed.
Absolutely, it was. I mean, I'm not a brilliant person. So whenever I listen to Peterson's lectures, I don't sit down and listen to 3 hours of it at a time. So typically I have to start over. I listen to the same lecture multiple times before I can fully understand what's going on in it. And that's what made that so difficult is because I knew that he wasn't going to put this out in recording.
Right.
And I wanted to hear what he was saying. So I'm like trying to map everything out and follow him in my brain the whole time.
Yeah.
It was difficult.
So for me, I found it engaging, but I also kept getting distracted by all the people moving, and I have ADD, and I found myself after an hour. So that first part about the perception I found really interesting, and then the second part I got kind of lost in my own mind. I was just like a little distracted by it, but you know what he talked about is he talked about this video, this study, where you are told to count the basketballs amongst this team, and in the middle of it, this guy in a gorilla suit walks by, and then nobody noticed it. Like 75% of the people didn't even see it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he talked about how in our world, our brains will fill in with our biases.
Yeah, you're,
so when I'm looking at Dakota, I can't fully wrap my mind around Dakota, and so my brain will kind of wrap existing things in my mind.
It's your memories. Your brain is forming visuals from past memories.
Right.
Which there's a little experiment that you can do with yourself, and that's focus on...
Oh, I do a lot of experiments with myself.
Well, just like if the next time, whenever you go to work tomorrow, you just sit down with one of the people that you have seen for years, and then don't look at their face as a whole, but like focus on one quadrant of their face, the next quadrant of their face. And it's appalling, really, because you have to. It makes you realize, like, what have I been seeing this entire time?
I had this experience in Vegas with my parents. You know, my dad turned 60. My mom turns, I think, 58 next month. And when we were in Vegas, it was the first time I'd really looked at my parents in a long time, and I saw age. Mm. You know, and they don't look bad, but I saw age. I saw them differently than the way that my brain has perceived them for 34 years.
Yeah.
You know, and then there was a little mini crisis around that because they're getting old, so am I. Oh my God, I'm 6 years from 40. I'm dying too. They're going to die, and we're all going to die. And then I went and gambled and drank myself to death. But
that's not true.
I did neither of those. but no, it was that moment of wow. Why have I not looked at their faces?
Yeah, it's a really weird feeling. Yeah, mm-hmm. And I mean, have you ever seen the show Brain Games?
Yes.
Yeah. Love that.
Yeah, explain it.
Okay, so Brain Games, basically, each episode is a different type of, I guess you could call it either auditory or visual illusions that they kind of do to trick your brain, and they tell you to focus on one thing, but basically just like the video. So you're told to count the balls that the basketball players are throwing back and forth. So you sit there and count the balls, and you miss the 6-foot-4 gorilla that comes into the middle of the screen and beats his chest. Then the next time that they play the video, this is what Peterson is saying, 60% of the people missed it. And then the next time that they play the video, the people automatically catch the gorilla, obviously, because mm-hmm. they knew it was coming.
They've been told about it.
Yeah. But what they don't realize was the entire backdrop, the entire background curtain and everything changed colors, changed from yellow to green. And they missed that, too. Wow. And that's basically what Brain Games does. So once you realize that, it's kind of like you want to immediately forget it.
And so this has been an important part and a value that has really become important to me over the last few years is the power of noticing and being present in your daily life. I think part of what I notice about myself and the way that I talk about things is different than the way that people on Facebook talk about things, because I really intentionally try to pay attention to every aspect of something. And so I think something like the immigration stuff, they just go with whatever the right says or whatever the left says.
My tribe said this.
And so there's not like that effort, the energy that it takes to like really constantly be noticing things wears you out. And I think that if you really pay attention to your surroundings, you start to pick up things that you start to notice things that other people don't.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and this is
the phone.
My God. I mean, I know I've become much, much worse.
I've cursed you many times because in 2010 you were like, you really need a smartphone. And so at the LPIN you helped me get an iPhone 3G and it's ruined my life. I'm like barely able to
read. I'm not sure if I had one at that
time. It is amazing though. I don't think that humans can, like you were just talking about, paying attention to things and really having to notice every little detail about it. I don't think that we can actually adequately do that. Because if we did try to do that, like on a realistic level with everything that pops across our news feed or your Twitter feed, you'd go insane.
It's exhausting.
Yeah.
It would be impossible.
The effort that will go in tomorrow, I will spend 3 hours of reading articles before tomorrow's show. I've already got all the articles picked out. It took me an hour to kind of go through and pick out what I want to read about this particular subject. And it will take another 2-3 hours just to read through everything that I think I need to know to really present to the audience. Like, people don't have that kind of time.
No.
You know, and that's just one issue.
That's a major investment.
It's one issue. I mean, it's really difficult in this day and age to keep track of everything. And that's the beauty of capitalism, is that somebody's passion is growing up and growing asparagus. Like, I don't know anything about asparagus. I don't care. You know, it's like the eye pencil, where you know you've got the rubber from Indonesia and the zinc from Kazakhstan and the wood from Brazil, and then you know it's all manufactured and put together. Like, not one person had to go around the world and collect these different pieces. Not one person invented, quote unquote, the materials to make the pencil. It spontaneously arose out of cooperation between human beings. And so why capitalism is brilliant is that it offsets so many functions in our daily life to the group. And so you have something like I know what to do with a microphone, but I don't need to spend my day building a microphone. I can just buy a microphone. And there's 100 different processes in the process and multiple people who are building the one piece of equipment that it takes to do the show. And 500 years ago, you didn't have that. You had to do everything on your own.
Right.
You know, Chris Spangle,
you were farming. You were subsistence. Being a blacksmith, right. And you were shoeing your horses so that you could hook up to the carriage that you made.
Right.
And take your family into the town with the clothes on their backs that your wife made. It's totally different.
At chrisspangle.com, I posted a video called iToaster, where this guy builds his own toaster, and it takes years, and he's mining copper and building plastic, and it looks like it's a mess. You should see it. It's a TED Talk. And so our brains work in very much the same way as that capitalistic theory. Like, our brains offload, like, I don't need to worry about this function. And I think part of what's happening in the digital age is that our brains are trying to, like, the chaos, the perceived chaos. I don't think anything's chaotic. I think we perceive that everything's chaotic and, oh gosh, I better start taking care of way more than I need to.
We've always perceived everything as chaos. There's not, I mean, look at ancient Greek Socratic writings. I mean, everything has always been chaos to the human mind. It's because the way that we view the world is, how can I best survive?
Right.
And so it's your chaos, seeing things as chaos is a survival instinct that we have. And we don't have to fight to survive anymore.
Yeah, well, it's bringing order to chaos, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
right.
And I think that's actually even one of Peterson's things that I listened to today, right? So, so, you know, yeah, the natural state of it is chaos. But what gives us, as humans, higher order, you know, intellectual abilities and or how that comes to fruition is by being able to bring order to the chaos.
Yeah.
Or one way.
No, that's totally right. Yeah.
Yeah, and the thing about Peterson is, to kind of go back to him before we kind of spin off into the next subject, I find nothing about him to be threatening. And so while I do believe in that crowd, there are a large group of, there is a percentage of that crowd that will do whatever he wants them to do, like any cult of personality. I'm okay with Jordan Peterson having that power.
So do we know where that comes from with him? Like, what was the tipping point? Like, where did this start with him? Because he's not. It's
Joe Rogan.
Okay,
so
was it Joe Rogan?
Yeah. So okay. Peterson has been known in Canada and on TVO, and he's been a professor forever and a clinical
psychologist.
And, you know, probably should have introduced who Jordan Peterson was for those of you who don't know, but I just imagine most people in this audience kind of know. But
everybody knows Jordan Peterson.
Right, so Peterson, but it's funny when you talk to libertarians, they're like, I don't know who that is. I have no idea. So Peterson is a clinical psychologist. He sees patients. He's a writer and researcher. He's a professor. And a lot of what he talks about is Jungian theory and dreams, and, you know, he talks a lot about archetypes and
talks a lot about mythology.
Mythology, you know, if you've ever watched The Power of Myth with Joseph Campbell and Bill Moyers, which I highly recommend, a lot of that is Jordan Peterson. He has a podcast series where he breaks down the Bible. And what Peterson does is he intertwines religion and history and anthropological studies and evolutionary psychology and clinical psychology and right-leaning politics, but he's very non-political to me. Like, he just doesn't seem like a political person. Like, he probably does, like, he'd probably vote conservative or libertarian, but he's not motivated
actually,
by politics.
In an interview, he was, they asked him if he had any political aspirations in Canada, and he said that he does not currently, but if he ran for office, it would probably be with the Liberal Party.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
All right. I mean, so he just doesn't seem to me, like, to me.
You were projecting?
I was. I mean, well, I guess I'm projecting based on the people that like him.
Yeah, but I don't think that's him at all, right?
He doesn't seem like a progressive liberal to me.
I think he's a bit of a classic liberal, right?
Yeah, totally.
In most ways, right? So, not to.
So, he melds all of these things into a framework, and through, you know, like when he breaks down the Bible, he talks about biblical archetypes and what are the echoes in other mythology and history that inform the, you know, the story of Moses, for instance, and the Exodus, and why does this happen, and how does that apply to the psychology of human beings and how we interact with each other?
Yeah, so it's all what
very
is
heady
this
stuff.
Telling us, you know, right. Like
what in the world is going on? I mean, I just don't understand.
The Bible lectures, the whenever he goes through the biblical stories, is probably my favorite lecture series that he has. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very, very good, very well thought out. He pours a lot of his own soul into this, into what he's talking about.
And it, his passion, he does pour a lot of his soul into everything he does.
Yeah. Absolutely.
To him, everything's important and everything has a meaning. And, like, the and I should pull up this one clip and play it for you guys, but so Peterson was a a figure in Canada who taught at the University of Toronto.
Yes, yeah. Correct. He was before that he was a professor at Harvard.
Okay.
And so he psychology.
And so Canada passed this law basically saying that you must legally use the pronouns of whatever or else you face penalties. And he says this is the road to tyranny. I'm not gonna, it's not that I'm not going to do that. I will use the pronouns of anyone, but to punish them by law to put them in a jail cell is wrong. Like
you was that the event that was the catalyst that launched him into
Canada was trying to pass it.
Yeah, Bill I'm aware. C-16, I remember when this happened. Yeah,
and he basically went on record at whenever he was at the University of Toronto and said, "No, you cannot force social change. Society has to evolve and change itself." Because he's like, it doesn't have a good look in history.
Yeah,
there's never been a good time in history where you have forced a societal change and it turned out well.
Where you've given up the right to free speech and the right to be offensive.
Mm-hmm.
Like to converse, you have to be offensive. You have to, there has to be social friction if you're having conversations about big ideas that matter.
Right.
And so he just basically says, like, you don't know what you're doing.
And it blew up the University of Toronto. So he, students started protesting him, of course, and he was being spat on, flogged in the streets pretty much. And it basically rocketed him forward. And then people started realizing that he had all these lectures on YouTube and he had the self-authoring program online. And then they were like, oh, he also has a book coming out. And it was like, and then all of a sudden, media started kind of twisting him into this alt-right type of figure. This liberal man is now an alt-right figure in the eyes of the media. So it became a really interesting dynamic to see how you can make those leaps. I mean, I still don't really understand it.
When you reject the... the attempt at forced PC, I mean, that's political correctness.
Right.
That's it. That's it's as simple as that, I think, Dakota, right? Yeah. Like, I mean,
you're forcing progress, which is not progress.
Him standing to that though is an immediate cue to a significant chunk of the Trump base, right? I think this is a piece that the media writ large, right, misses completely about why Trump is Trump, right? Where his support comes from, right?
Right.
Is the anti-political correctness side that he has embraced and turned into part of his whole thing.
Right.
Right?
That's the number one factor.
After
party identity, the number one reason that people support Donald Trump is anti-PC culture.
Yeah.
We talked a lot about that in the last episode or two. I mean, where the left doesn't realize that they're creating more Donald Trump supporters
by trying to be more PC. Absolutely.
Yeah. You look at something and the boy who cried wolf and he's Hitler and blah blah blah. All that has exhausted people to the point that when something legitimately wrong like the kids at the border thing pops up, everybody goes, yeah, but I don't believe you anymore. I don't care. You lie about Jordan Peterson. You lie about Donald Trump. And so, therefore, you're lying about me and what I believe. So, here's the finger.
Yeah.
4 more years, Donald Trump.
Yep.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, I think Mark Brim, who he's been on the Boss Hog of Liberty a few times, he said...
What's that? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Never heard of her.
Now, Mark posted on his Facebook page, he's like, every time a Robert De Niro type gets on stage and screams "F you Trump," then a never Trump Republican jumps on his ticket, which is right. You know, it's totally right because you're taking the common sense of politics away. I mean, there's absolutely zero of it, and then you see a guy who goes up there and says that he's not going to take it anymore, and that resonates with a lot of people. It really does because you're not actually thinking about the platform or the things that he's saying other than, oh, I hate CNN is fake news. You know, like it. I mean, I know you've talked about that a lot, but
Yeah, so Peterson goes on Joe Rogan's podcast, and then people start downloading his lectures, and it's just an example of somebody who has been working hard in the dark for a long time and then gets some exposure, and then all of a sudden everybody's like, this guy's awesome. You know, he really... I mean, his the first time he was on Joe Rogan, it was so mind-bending. Like, it was just like, who is this guy? This is all the stuff I believe, but he's put it in a framework, and where did that come from? And then, you know, he came on a few more times, and then he, you know, started doing interviews about the book that he wrote, which was an opportunity carved out by going on Rogan, frankly.
Yep.
And then he just, like, his YouTube and his Patreon and everything shot up, and I can't imagine how much money this guy's making. Like, yeah, it's crazy. So
At one point, I think I saw his Patreon was, like, over $350,000 a month.
Jeez.
Wow. Yeah. And then
the taxes. Can you imagine?
No. Especially in Canada.
Oh.
Yeah. So you saw him from the Joe Rogan episode.
Yes.
I saw him from the Kathy Newman interview. That was the first time
I ever really? Heard Just him. Then, too? Okay.
I think that was really the moment when he went from kind of like that under, like, everybody in our world kind of knows Tom Woods and kind of knows, you know, Dave Smith and kind of knows Chris Spangle and kind of knows Dave Rubin. But then, like, that Kathy Newman thing, that was the moment that everybody went, what is this?
Yeah.
Yep. So.
No, that was huge. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a big, I saw that somebody shared the interview in one of the Facebook groups that I'm in, and I was like, this guy is awesome. Like, he is really
What
amazing.
Stuck out about that to you?
It was just, it was the most apparent example of construing a person's words. So taking their words completely out of context, and what he's saying makes total sense. It's been common sense for the past, you know, millennia. And then this guy starts talking about it, and all of a sudden, because he says that there is a natural hierarchy in our brains that runs off of serotonin, and you think, and he says, he doesn't say, well, that is for sure. He says, there's some evidence because of other biological creatures. And she says, so what you're saying is that, you know, women like to be oppressed. And he's, you know, that
right.
that blew my mind, and it just really resonated with me. So I just started looking him up more.
Yeah, I mean, for me, his ability to remain calm and measured and respond without devolving into what we typically see, that to me is what, I mean, because somebody trying to, like, take an interview and construe and project and, you know, try to own the narrative, that's nothing new.
Right.
Right. Right. Like what Kathy Newman did, you know, you can go on, you know, Fox News or MSNBC and see that anytime you want, but his ability to kind of stick with it and be calm and not shut down, right? Like, what I found to be fascinating.
Attractive. He's attractive because he's the anti-Trump. And everybody is so out of... Everybody's so wacky and over the top. Like, and that's always been my biggest contention about Donald Trump, is that it's just like the book about Rome, you know, Storm Before the Storm. The breakdown of Mos Maiorum and the norms that keep the Republican place that the Gracchi brothers destroyed leads you to dangerous places because other people start to imitate. It's like the first guy who climbs Mount Everest, everybody goes, I should climb Everest.
Right.
And so Donald Trump has always been a dangerous figure to me because, like, if he existed in a vacuum and he were gone in 3 to 7 years or whatever, and we never had his style of politics ever again, and, like, the populism faded instantly, then so what? But it's going to continue.
Yeah.
And this boneheaded nonsense, I'm just dealing with idiots every day. Like, everybody's tired of dealing with idiots.
Yeah, I doubt we're going to see a quick return to intellectualism.
No, and not that. And I think they're like in that bonus episode that you and I recorded. Like, we're talking about the cream of the crop, the people whose names have withstood history, but we're ignoring the billions of people that existed on the planet during those time periods that were boneheads. And there's far less boneheads now. And a far higher percentage of intellectual, smart people. I think one person said to me, they said, I know a lot of smart, intelligent people. I don't know a lot of deep people. And I thought that was interesting. I think that's part of what the appeal of Jordan Peterson is that he's deep. He's trying. He's trying to understand the world around him, trying to get it to make sense, trying to prevent the kind of world that Trump has created.
Yeah.
You know, and you can support Trump and his policies. That's fine. That's fine with me. But, you know, and there's things that he does that I like. So I'm not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I'm like not a never Trumper. I'm like a almost don't agree with Donald Trump on most stuff.
Yeah.
Trumper. Like he's, but as far as being a human being, like there's many different ways to judge an individual. You know, especially a politician. There's their policies that they actually enact. There's the tactics that they use. There's their personal character. There's all these different ways that you evaluate somebody. And Donald Trump, in terms of his personal character, is just a grotesque person. And you look at somebody who is using, who is intentionally using separations at the border, traumatizing children and families. Little children are changing diapers because guards aren't allowed to touch the kids for legal reasons, and their parents are in a holding cell. And then Donald Trump's like, well, that's their problem. Too bad. Like, those are human beings. Those are people.
Yeah.
Like, that's a person. You know, whereas Jordan Peterson looks at it and goes, yeah, there's the law, but there's also, I don't know. He just is, to me, a cool drink of empathetic water in a society that has just lost its way in terms of values and morals and principles. And is he a redo of a lot of ideas? Yeah. But that's the point of this, is that as we talk with each other, you're hearing us have a conversation as we figure stuff out. You listen to the course of this podcast. Like, term limits for me is something where if you listen to the beginning of the podcast, I'm against term limits. I'm now more for term limits than I am against them, because the conversation of this podcast over the course of many years has changed my mind on things. I don't have to be so inflexible and so hardcore and like
flip-flopper.
Right, exactly. Like, for that cheap political win, I think that's why people have responded to this show so well, is that I invite people like you two on who are not looking to be inflexible and partisan and own the libs or cons. Like, you're just trying to figure stuff out and like talk about your world and go, okay, this, what's this makes, how does this make sense and all that. So, before we kind of transition, this is a little bit of a long clip. It's about 6 minutes long, but I think as we transition into the other thing, this is the best thing I've ever heard Jordan Peterson say. Like, it completely changed. I spent all of 2016 thinking about the question, how does a society like Germany devolve into Nazi Germany and exterminating 20 million people? How does that happen? Mm-hmm. How do they let that happen? And he kind of talks about that, and
he kind of talked about it in the show that we went to as well. Yeah,
I think
you might have missed it while you were stuck in pee-pee.
I was stuck in pee-pee. I was dealing with the reality of sitting in pee-pee.
Did you miss that part when you talked about Auschwitz?
Kind of, yeah.
I could lost, tell on his face that he's like,
no memory whatsoever. No memory whatsoever.
It was during the Q&A.
What'd he say?
It was about how he stays humble.
Yeah. About how basically he's like, I could be that person.
Yeah, and it's terrifying.
Talk about his answer for the people. So not only just you and I have the benefit. Do you remember really kind of what he said?
Does your clip cover it?
Kind of.
A little bit, but yeah. I think I know what clip you're going to show. I think I've watched it. But
it's from podcast episode two in the feed, but tragedy.
He basically So someone says, how do you become famous at the age of 50 overnight? You're a multimillionaire. How do you stay so humble? And he, of course, as you know, I don't want to say that I'm humble necessarily, but I like to think that I keep my feet on the ground. And he said, so how I do that is I sit and I thought about Auschwitz. And I thought, this is weird.
He knows how to party, yeah.
I'm like, where is this going? And then he says,
how do you stay humble? I just like to think about burning dead Jews. Like, whoa.
Yeah, wow. It was a huge leap. But then he explained himself. It made sense because he said that he sat there and he thought about it. How can a person become so evil? How can a regular man become... complacent.
Kiss his wife as he leaves the door, go out, exterminate Jews, come home and kiss his wife and act as if nothing is different.
And he said that, well, I first realized that if I was in Nazi Germany, I very well could have done
been
that.
One of those guys,
he said, and then the further that I thought about it, I realized I would have done that. And then I realized that as a Nazi in Nazi Germany, I could have enjoyed it. He said, and that is the most terrifying thing that a human can think. So he just, that's what he thinks about. And that's what keeps him humble, I guess. It's pretty strange. But, like, if you listen to his other stuff, it makes sense. Like, his whole entire house is decorated with Soviet-era communist artwork.
Mm-hmm.
So Luke writes in the chat, mob mentality means that individuals lose responsibility proportionally to the number of people doing similar things, and it's a monster that feeds on itself. And that's exactly right. Once you as a society have given yourself permission to do a certain thing, and it becomes, it's like abortion. Like, I don't know about you two, but I'm pro-life, and I believe that child in the womb has all of the natural rights that you and I enjoy. Yep. Now I fully understand that there are people who don't agree with that.
We are guaranteed the opportunity for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Right.
If you cut off a life before you can take its first breath, then that's a fundamental right you're taking away.
And I'm sorry, I don't buy the Rothbard theory of that baby is trespassing, so you have the right to evict it.
Okay. Well, there's the. All right, bro. I mean, there's a separate theme.
Gotta love
of evictionism.
Like, go ahead, Dick.
There's a separate theme of evictionism, which we're not there yet in mm-hmm. our medical field, but basically if you could remove the fetus and then it could be born, quote-unquote, born in an incubation chamber and then put up for adoption, then that would be the safer alternative to abortion.
Sure.
Which is fine.
I'm down with that. I mean, as long as you're protecting life, but... Like, to me, to get to a place in America where 100 years ago progressives developed, you know, euthanasia and abortion as a way to control black populations, and then all of a sudden it becomes a right and a natural, like, part of our life, and it's socially acceptable, like, I mean, that's kind of what that means. Like, things get so far that as it goes through the generations, it just becomes enshrined in that generation, and that's a huge problem. Not just abortion, but that whole mentality,
right.
Is what I mean. And that's why I am so aggressive about protecting free speech. Like, it doesn't matter if you think, like, yes, property owners and business owners have the right to fire an NFL player who doesn't stand for the national anthem. But when you're not aggressively protecting free speech, which is the cornerstone of liberty, it is the cornerstone of good societies, then that erodes very quickly. Like, the Joe Rogan interview with Douglas McMurray, the guy who wrote The Strange Death of Europe, I will put that, I think it's Douglas Murray, I will put that in the show notes. But they spend a lot of time talking about free speech and Charlie Hebdo, like, even to the extreme limits where you're doing something that can cost you your life, like, you're being provocative to the point that you get killed. It doesn't matter if the cartoon was funny or not. You have to support that right, because if you don't, then it's just an erosion of that entire concept.
And I think I skipped over that episode, but now I have to go listen to it.
Yeah. I have the book over there. One of my 125 library books that I've got checked out. But and that's
those are all library books?
That's not even an exaggeration, Dakota. Yeah.
No.
That's not an exaggeration at all.
Do they let you
How many
do
late
that?
Fees do you have?
You don't have any late fees. You just keep renewing them. You go through, and like, you don't read most nonfiction books all the way through. You kind of skim through them, right? I mean, you read the intro. That gives you most of the information in the book. You kind of read through, look at the pictures and the charts and all that, and move on your way. You know? Like, so...
That's what you do when you're trying to refresh your memory on what it said.
Well, that's, I mean, maybe, but that's how I do it. All right. So here's this clip from Jordan Peterson.
I think there's evidence throughout history that it's possible for people to be enlightened. And you'd think, since enlightenment is viewed as the medication for vulnerability and death, that everybody would be struggling as hard as they possibly could to be enlightened, if such a state exactly and precisely exists. But if the barrier to enlightenment is the development of self-consciousness of the individual human's infinite capacity for evil, then you can be immediately convinced about why enlightenment is in such short supply. When I finished my first provisional examination of the sorts of motivations that drove people to set up concentration camps and to torture people terribly in those camps, I came to a terrible conclusion. It was a conclusion that I think in some ways was the worst thing that had ever happened to me, maybe intellectually and morally. I came to understand why it is that people depended on their group identity and their cultural identification, because that helped protect themselves from their own vulnerability. You have to believe things, because you just don't know everything. So you have to believe things. They fill in the gaps. The beliefs fill in the gaps. If the beliefs are stripped from you, then your defenses against the infinite are stripped, and it's no wonder that people will defend their beliefs. I thought, well, you do, if you're too involved in defending your beliefs, you're going to be willing to kill other people in their defense, and we're so technologically powerful now that we can no longer be willing to kill other people in the defense of our own beliefs, because the time for that is past. And I realized, well, if you don't stand up for your beliefs, you leave yourself bereft, you're open to the depredations of the infinite. That's equally intolerable. It seems to leave no way out. There is a way out, you know, and I think it's the way out that genuinely religious people have tried to offer humanity for thousands and thousands of years. And the way out of the conundrum posed to you by your reliance on ideological beliefs and your vulnerability in the face of the unknown is the development of a truly integrated and powerful character. And that's a individual development. And it means constant confrontation with things you don't understand and constant attempts to ensure that your character is composed of truth and solidity rather than deceit, and to make of yourself something that's built on a rock and not predicated on sand. And the thing is, it's one thing to tell people that because maybe they should take care of themselves. But I don't know if that's enough to tell people, because they don't take care of themselves that well. But it's a completely other thing to say, look, you know, every time you make a pathological moral decision, you move the world one step closer to complete annihilation. And I absolutely believe that. I think the historical evidence is crystal clear. And I also think that every time you make an appropriate moral decision and you manifest moral courage in the face of your own vulnerability, then you move the world one step farther from the brink. And that's the case for every single person. You know, Solzhenitsyn said, drawing on his Eastern Orthodox Christian background, every single person is the center of the world, a center of the world, not the center of the world. The world's a complicated place. It can have all sorts of centers. It's hard to believe that you might be one of them, but everything about human existence is hard to believe. The fact that it's here at all is hard to believe. The nature of it's hard to believe. Everything that human beings does is so ridiculous and remarkable that it's like it's a consistently and constantly unfolding miracle. The idea that each of you might be a center of the cosmos in that infinite admixture of ridiculousness and absurdity is hardly more than one more ridiculous thing to swallow. Well, I'll summarize, I guess. I said that tragedy is a precondition for being. Being is the interplay between the finite and the infinite. And in that interplay, there's tragedy, and there's no way out of that. Evil's something different. Evil's the conscious attempt to make the conditions of existence more pathological than they have to be. And it's motivated by conscious intent. The motivations arise because people pay a terrible price for their self-conscious awareness, and that awareness is their awareness of their vulnerability. And that is a terrible thing to be aware of. That vulnerability can be confronted forthrightly, accepted, and the appropriate decisions made. Alternatively, people can retreat into their own rationalistic arrogance and attempt to deceive themselves and everyone else about the nature of their own existence and about the nature of reality. That pathway leads to nothing but destruction. I think that there's good reason to assume that it's too late in the in our developmental course as a species for that path to be acceptable anymore, because we're too powerful. And if too many people stay on that path, we're going to do ourselves in. And so I would say, as we've become more technologically powerful, an increasing moral burden is being placed on each of us. It matters to the destiny of the cosmos whether or not you get your moral act straight. And I don't mean that in a trivial way. I believe that that's as close to an empirical fact as anything that can be demonstrated. And I also believe that's as terrifying a thing to consider as anything you could possibly imagine. And maybe it's too much to ask of people. But you know, our great religious traditions do continually remind us that inside every human being there's a spark of divinity. And that idea is a precondition for our entire system of law. There's always the possibility that it's true. And if it's true, it means that there's an infinite avenue of potential that lays open to every single person, and that the ability to transform the terrible conditions of reality into something not only acceptable but worthy of celebration actually lies within our grasp. And the alternative to that is the continual generation of a kind of hell that's so incomprehensibly awful that by any reasonable person's standards it has to be regarded as something to avoid. That's all I have to say about that.
That's all I got to say about that.
Well, I have been received a text message that is so infinitely mind-bendingly awful that it has thrown my cosmos into inordinate chaos.
I forgot about this.
Yeah, can we bring some order to Chris?
This is the worst text message you can possibly receive. It's from my mother.
Oh no.
Need tech, my son. My Viera stopped working. Panasonic TV, Google, didn't help. I have sound, can't mute. Home theater's working. Shrug emoji. Can you help? Period.
I love that.
This explains my childhood. It's a control issue. Shocked emoji. 1966. Period. I have to actually get up and turn it up or down. Period. White person problem. So lame.
White person problem.
It's funny. That's cute. That's cute.
Your mother's racist, I think.
No, I don't know. No, she's not. She's, trust me, she's very not racist. Let's not talk about my dad. I think you hear someone in that conversation talking about how they work out what they believe and how they approach the world. And I think for me, I'm constantly thinking about and evaluating my interaction with other people, with the world, with myself. How do things apply to my belief system? I'm constantly trying to think those things out. And I think one thing that a lot of people haven't done in this day and age is they don't sit down and think about their personal values. They just sort of exist. They go to work. They wake up, they go to McDonald's, they get a coffee and a McMuffin, and then they go to work, and they chat about fantasy football, and they pretend to work and look at memes, and then they go home, and then, you know, maybe they get Chick-fil-A on the way home, and then they come and play Fortnite, and then they fall asleep after they've, you know, beat off or whatever. And, like, that's just sort of their existence, you know, and maybe they have kids, and they find some level of meaning in kids, and, you know, then their kids grow up and become awful, horrible 13-year-olds. How's things going for you? Everything good?
Not quite 13 yet.
All right, good. So you still got time. Like I always say, like I may move to a different state, something with more sunshine when my nieces stop being cute.
Mm-hmm.
So like I've got like 10 years when they're adorable, and then I just don't want to talk to them. Like,
just be away.
Yeah. Goodbye.
How old are they?
They're 2 and 4.
So yeah. So you got about 10 years.
They're perfect. Yeah. They're great. 14-year-old, I don't want to deal with those. I saw their mom, okay? I lived with their mother. with those emotions. And the older one has all the... It's funny. I prayed for my sister to have girls, and she got two just like her. It's hilarious. So I think people just kind of don't sit there and do the work of thinking about what they believe. And so the first question in that is, what makes up a value system? What are the essential pieces of a value system that you need to figure out what you believe? It's not just as simple as, I'm a Christian, I'm a liberal, and I want people to be nice to each other. Like,
to figure out what a value system is, though, you really have to look at yourself, think about what values mean to you. Like, what is the pragmatic truth of value? So I'm asking you right now, whenever you say a value system.
So you're wanting me to pay attention instead of reading the chat? Gotcha. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
So I was trying to formulate this as we're going, right? But I mean, I think, you know, if I had to define a value system, you know, it's a set of, you know, principles or guideposts, right, that are going to help you govern your decision making in terms of, you know, how you choose what's right and what's wrong.
Right.
Right. And that can come from so many different places. Right. And I don't, you know, I think it's certainly multi-layered and complex. Right. But I think when you try to boil it down to be like, you know, hey, what is your value system? You know, it comes to your worldview, your North Star, right? How do you, when you sit back to have to dissect, you know, how you're going to make decisions, you know, what's going to govern that process.
Right. You know, here's a list of values for, as an example, to kind of get you to thinking about what that word is defined as: achievement, advancement, adventure, affectionness. What is that? We're going on like hour five of podcasting. Cooperation, creativity, emotional security, fame, family happiness, freedom, friendship, health, helpfulness, wisdom, wealth, responsibility, self-respect, power, pleasure, loyalty, integrity, inner harmony. So it's things that set up how you control yourself, and then also how you interact with other individuals.
Yeah, that's one of the things I wanted to point out, was that you're reading this list off. Obviously, fame isn't, it doesn't even cross my mind whenever I come up with the things that, whenever I think about morality.
Well, you have it, so.
You know, like.
You have fame already.
No, but that can be a value. Somebody can have that as a value.
Exactly,
right?
And that's what I'm trying to point out. While it might not be for me, you know, other people want fame. That's a part of their value structure. Like, which I guess the point I'm trying to make is it's all on an individual basis.
Right.
You have to derive your value system based on yourself.
Right. What do you think is important in life?
Correct.
If my motivation, like, don't know if I've talked about this on the podcast or not, but my motivation to do We Are Libertarians is not to get famous. This is not a stepping stone for me to get something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you see that value in the way that I do content and the way that I interact with the audience compared to maybe some other podcasters who are using this as a stepping stone to build an audience that will better leverage them into a better opportunity according to them. And so the way that they conduct their show is different than the way that I conduct my show, because my value is equally as selfish, but in a different way. Like, my value in doing this is that I want to better understand the news of the day and the stories of the day. And so I do a lot of reading, and I would never do the amount of research and reading if I didn't actually have a deadline. And
why?
Because I want to better understand how the world operates.
Why?
Because I find it interesting. I don't and I don't know that there's a why to that. I think
I stopped for a second.
For me, I think the why is that it's mentally and emotionally stimulating. Mm-hmm. That if I don't have the focus of figuring out these different trends or doing the show, like my brain, it's like you know, when the pace car hit the wall the other day in the IndyCar race, it's like the 900 horsepower car hit and then just swerved and hit the wall. Like for me, this keeps me stimulated, and you know, because I don't know, I just enjoy it. And the other part is I find friendship through this, not just with people like you two, but also with the audience, and so that I find meaning in that group.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I do this stuff.
So seeking identity.
Sure. Right? Yep.
Seeking, you know, companionship.
Sure.
And then, you know, I think the intellectual curiosity side of it, the mental stimulation side of it, I think there's another level there. I'm not sure what it is, right? But it seems like you're seeking to avoid something else there, maybe. Like, what happens when you don't get that stimulation?
Well, I get bored, and I don't like to be bored. And then I start thinking about... See, here's the thing.
It's like Adventure Time on Cartoon Network.
Well, you go ahead.
Dang it, I can't remember the old man's name. Do you remember?
No.
Old man with the big head and...
Ted Kennedy.
No. But they're the... And basically, characters say, why don't we do something scary tonight? The old man says, we can go to bed early and be alone with our thoughts.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That to me is...
That's a huge part of it, yes. It is a way to cope.
No, I'm just trying to see if there's like a value that you're also seeking through that, right? You know?
I don't know if this is a value necessarily, but it's more of a function of health. Like for me, as I talked about in the depression episode, like there are a lot of good ways and bad ways to cope with your emotions. And I have a lot of emotions, and I have a lot of feelings. Mm-hmm. And if I don't channel that intensity into something healthy, then I can channel it into something unhealthy.
Yeah.
And so if it doesn't...
But I mean, I think the thing there is your values guide you to a definition of what's healthy for you and what's unhealthy for you.
Absolutely.
And that's the important piece here, I think.
And I am informed on what is healthy for me by... personal experience, but also the knowledge that the world provides. You know, I know I've tried high carb and I have tried high fat diets. The paleo high fat diet makes me lose weight and makes me feel good. The high carb diet makes me feel like garbage and I gain weight no matter how hard I work out. I can not work out and lose weight on a high fat diet, for instance. So that personal experience, because there's research out there, there's knowledge out there on both of these, there's people who are desperately passionate, including my trainer, who are like, high carb is the way to go. Mm-hmm. Low fat, high carb. And I'm just like, sorry, dude. I know that you have this level of authority in my life and you have more knowledge about this, but my personal experience informs my decision making about my diet. You know, but when it comes to exercise, I listen to him because my personal experience from his knowledge is always right. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a combination of, I think first and foremost, you have to be in the world. You have to be engaging in the world and you have to have some level of social friction. And I think you have to open yourself
up. Who has to? What do you mean by this?
I think everyone. I think that if you...
Everyone should or everyone has to?
I think everyone has to grow. So
does everyone have to grow?
The world would be a better place if they did.
So that's your value system.
Fair enough. I think I have a personal disdain for people who have the same. They come to me for advice for the same thing for 5 years straight. like to me
for in 5 years, I'm going to be sending you videos of our board set up and
no, like that's
no, like
that's friends helping.
I know what you're saying. Like, I need help.
I can't do this. I can't, but I'm depressed. It's like, well, did you go to therapy? Like I told you, did you go talk about antidepressants?
Right.
No. Did you, like, I have a very, I will talk to that person. I will be that person's friend. I will help them. But there is a little bit of, how many more fucking times do I have to tell you this?
Right.
Same piece of information before you finally listen to me. Don't you recognize that I have some experience? And so I think people will reject.
No, you. So you certainly value personal progress. That is part of your value system.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so I think a key part of personal progress is having conversations like this with friends like Matt, who have known you for a long period of time and can reflect back to you your behavior, your thinking, can help you break that down. And so I think having a healthy social life is important in terms of determining what you believe, because people don't think in a vacuum. You think in groups.
Yeah.
So, and I think if you're not talking with friends, and that requires being open and vulnerable and accepting of hearing things that you may not totally like.
Right. It's you said that we think in groups, and that sounds like a collectivist idea, but no. I mean, it's really not.
Sure.
No. I mean, I just wanted to.
Is your thinking function extroverted?
Oh, for sure.
Okay, see, my thinking function's introverted.
Yeah, me too.
Right? So my intuition function is extroverted.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I want to be around the group from a gathering information perspective.
Right.
But the thinking is internalized.
You'd rather hear me and, what are you again? Are you an INTJ?
Yes.
All right, leave. Get out. INTJs are my mortal enemy as an ENFJ. But
no, actually, I'm not. I think I'm.
You don't come across as an INTJ.
I forget. I honestly forget.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think I'm INSP, maybe.
Maybe. You don't seem like an INTJ. You're not socially awkward and annoyed with me all the time. And Luke wants to know, do you think a bunch of acquaintances and shallow friends are better than a couple of core deep friends? I would ask you if you think that that there's something that I'm communicating that you were hearing differently. So, like, did you ask that question because you think I'm saying that? Or are you genuinely asking? If you're genuinely asking, I think deep friends, deep friendships are far... Intimacy is important. And I don't mean intimacy in the way that I mean, like... how you make babies.
Yeah.
Important, but that's not what I mean. Like the idea that two people, two individuals connect to each other deeply over a long period of time is incredibly important.
It's a value you have.
Right. Yeah. Whereas I think popularity, which is just having a bunch of acquaintances, it doesn't really do much for you. Like
for you again, like that can be somebody's value.
I don't know anybody out there who's like, I don't know anybody out there who has a genuinely healthy emotional life who is sitting there going, yeah, I don't want any deep friends. Like, I feel like there are some things that are so inherent in human beings.
Challenging you at the meta level though here a little bit, right? Yeah. Like, does that just because, okay, if that person's not truly then satisfied, what does that mean? Does that mean they have no values?
How do you know that they're not satisfied in their life, emotionally speaking?
Well, I can't know. I mean, you only know about me what I choose to share out of my face.
Yeah.
You know? I think there are a certain set of things that are healthy behavior for human beings emotionally.
Yeah.
The same that... No one disputes that exercise is good for you. We can argue what exercise is best for you and best for what joints or whatever, but by and large, our bodies are meant to move and not to be sedentary, right? And I think the same is it's the same with emotional health and mental health and deep friendships and relationships with people is core to being a healthy person. And I think if you look at your life and you have a lot of people in your life and you wouldn't go to their funeral, that's a problem.
Yeah.
Like that's the most profound thing that Maya ever said to me. She goes, "We're not friends, you'd never come to my funeral." And I was like, "Oh, that's true." and we became better friends after that because I realized, like, I want friendships in my life with people who would want to come to my funeral and vice versa because they genuinely want to show up and grieve because I had an impact on their life, not because they're showing up because the community showed up and they want to, like, it's not social obligation. It's out of we had a genuine
respect.
Connection.
Yeah.
Exactly sure. Right. And so I think that might be a good guide marker for people. I think relationships on a deep level are just, it's not a personal value. I think it's just a human need.
No, so I agree with what you're saying, right? And I guess part of what I'm teasing out for myself as I'm, you know, prompting you and teasing it out through you a little bit, right, is like, to what end? Okay, right? So I would come at this and say, I mean, everybody has a value system,
mm-hmm.
right? But clearly, you know, depending on what you want to define as, whether it's success or happiness or being a good person or whatever label you want to put on that kind of, you know, means to the end, or not means to the end, I guess, mm-hmm. right? Is that the value system, does it get you there?
Right.
Right? And everybody's definition of what there is going to be a little bit different
sure.
too, right? And so that, I mean, to put, this comes into the question of, like, then should we pass judgment on other people's value systems?
No, because I think openness is an important value for healthy social interaction. Like, it is important for me to...
Well, let me interrupt you real quick. If somebody, you know, finds through their value system that it's okay for them to go murder people, you would not say that that's a good value system.
No, not at
right?
all.
So I think there is a line there.
Yeah, but if part of your value system is it's okay to go murder someone,
what drove that?
You're mentally ill.
Yeah, and so maybe the question is, what relationship does your personal value system have with the interaction of the outer world? So
yes.
your personal values may not interact well with the outer world, like murdering them, you know? Like,
okay, let's lighten the word. Let's choose kill instead of murder.
Okay.
No, this is an important distinction.
Sure.
Would you go serve in the military and
right.
kill people on the battlefield?
I couldn't.
I wouldn't, no.
Okay, but lots of people do. Are they all mentally ill, Dakota?
It's not murdering.
Well, this is a libertarian podcast, so there's no.
You're gonna.
I think it's hard to say that they're mentally ill, right?
But think of the.
They're governed
the
by a value system, right?
They're governed by a value system, but I
would say that maybe their value system, for instance, patriotism, may be a higher value than the taking of the life of someone else. I think for me, the value on human life, the inherent value that every person has is one of the central values of my life, which is informed because of my Christian values.
Right.
And my Christian values, my libertarian values, which are essentially not using force to achieve social or political goals, to go back to the non-aggression principle, like, to me, to kill is something that I, unless it is in self-defense, I could not do it. I could not go serve in the military because I don't have the attachment to a higher cause like patriotism that would allow me to violate those values unless that is inverted. And patriotism were the higher value than killing, for instance, or using the concept of force. And part of it is that I value individualism, and not everybody thinks like that, which
right.
is very clear. I believe that if I am faced with a Vietnamese person in the Vietnam War, I believe that's a human being with the right to live. And the concept that our governments are fighting with each other does not justify me taking their life. There are other people who believe that for the collective good, we must invade Vietnam and stop the communists from invading, and these are just the costs. So Christy Avery just joined and said, what is this even?
I see what you're saying, though, but I want to point out, okay, you said, are people in the military mentally ill? Because they signed up and said there's a possibility I could kill someone, correct? Well, I do want to point out that the high amounts of PTSD, mm-hmm. I mean, there are staggering amounts of military veterans that do suffer greatly from mental illness.
Absolutely.
I don't think whether there's a correlation.
I think that's but we're talking about mostly.
Well, right, because you kill someone, and it's not good.
Yeah.
It's not inherently in our nature to want to kill someone. It's not biologically there.
I think it is biological. I think it is inherent. Yeah. I think so. Let's just flat out say, people in the military are not mentally ill. Let's
make that clear. I definitely don't believe that. Right. By the way,
we're not, for instance,
we're not Arvin Voorhees
right here. But the reason that I have a lot of the values that I have, like I've always said, I'm not libertarian because I'm an objectivist who just believes this is the right social order. Like I'm a libertarian because the government just flat out doesn't work. Like I'm informed by results. So I have taken information. You go and you listen to the cost episodes and tell me that the government works.
All right.
And that the government is good for individuals. You know, I mean, I have 10 principles of weird libertarianism, and maybe we could walk through these too that we could just revisit because it might help with the discussion. But, you know, I think there's a lot of thinking that you have to do about what do you actually believe and how do you interact with others? Because I constantly say that a vote is an extension of your values. Mm-hmm. And if you have no idea what your values are, then you have no idea what policies to support or what candidates to support. And so for me, the idea that I would steal from Dakota or that Matt and I would vote to steal from Dakota is not something that I would do in an interpersonal situation. And so therefore, I don't believe that it is morally right for the government to do it. I'm also cognizant that we live in reality and that in our lifetime, unless nuclear war happens, we're probably the chances of having an anarchist government are low, but low. Well, you never know with technology. I mean, we talked about changing realities earlier, but you know, and so if we have to work in the framework of the world, we have to take our personal values and the things that we believe, and then negotiate with other people who have different values and different philosophies of government to try and get the best outcomes, and so. You have to go and talk to people and engage with people and find out why do you believe what you believe? How could you be a progressive liberal who is against free speech? What are the experiences that inform you? And through that connection with someone else, then they see you as a human, you see them as a human, and then you can negotiate to a place that is healthy for everybody.
How did you develop your moral code, for lack of a better term?
So part of, and I don't know if it was Peterson who has talked about it, but part of the purpose of political philosophy or general philosophy or religion, it is mental software that is quickly uploaded to the brain. Mm-hmm. So there are things that I think all the time, and then I say them, and then somebody goes, oh yeah, Rothbard wrote about that 30 years ago, you know, where you're like, oh, this isn't new territory, you know? And so if someone can hand you a framework of things and then you start picking that apart based on your experiences, then you kind of go, okay, this is what I believe. So for me personally, I would say that I grew up very independent. I have always been very iconoclastic. I have always been very anti-authoritarian. I get that from my dad. I would say that a lot of my personality is a blend of both of my parents. So obviously many of my beliefs and biases and those things come from my parents. And then I became a Christian at 18. And then so you are given this this set of values, and it's not handed to you. You're kind of like in the dark groping an elephant trying to figure out what it is.
So you weren't raised in church?
I was not. I was an atheist till I was 17, and I read Hermann Hesse, Siddhartha, and I became a Buddhist. I was like, this seems really cool, and it was a way to deal with the emotional pain I was going through. Like, Buddhism was a release of that pain, and then 9/11 happened, and I was like, maybe I should check out Christianity, and then 2 years down the road, like, almost immediately I became Christian, but then really took me, like, 2 years to fully understand what it all meant. I still, every day, learn something new about the religious framework, You know, so it's been 20 years and I'm still figuring it out. And yeah. It's the same with libertarianism. It's been a 10-year process.
Were you, was it an atheist household or was atheist a rejection, rejection?
It was
of...
my rejection.
Okay.
And I'll tell you where it came from. It came from first grade. My mom felt that we should have some level of religious connection because she grew up in a Catholic school environment. And so she took us to Sunday school about once every 2 months and they had a sticker chart. And every time I showed up, everybody had all these long lines of stickers, and I had one, and then I would be made, I would be shamed and guilted for not having enough stickers, mm-hmm. as if it was me at first grade telling my mom we were going to get up early and go to church. And so from that experience, I developed a deep hatred for any Christians. And then you buy into the worldview of all Christians are evil, all Christians are bad, Christianity is a hateful religion, and you adopt that cultural mm-hmm. message. Mm-hmm. And you go, well, this must be the reality. And then you have to open your mind. I opened my mind and accepted that maybe I was wrong and started learning more. And I was like, no, this actually makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
And it's the same with politics. I grew up in a Republican household. I had all these beliefs. I was challenged by Andy Horning and Abdul. They were constantly picking apart my beliefs. And I had no answer for it. And so when you have no answer, what do? You go look for an answer. And then eventually you kind of go, wow, no, I'm really a libertarian. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of these beliefs are inherent in some ways. And then you are constantly negotiating with the world and defending your positions and trying to understand your personal experiences and emotions. And then going, okay, that's what this is. The world kind of like... You have these human experiences and these human emotions and these human behaviors, and then the world defines them because they've already been like humans have existed for so long and talked about so many things and written about so many things. And then you realize like, oh, Augustine wrote about this in 300.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think the inherent word would be the one I was going to maybe pick at a little bit, but I think the way you described it afterwards, right? I mean, I'm much more of a nurture over nature guy, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think we're hardwired with our values per se, right? I mean, I think there's certain tendencies from evolutionary biology and all that fun stuff, and evolutionary psychology as well, right? But I think the shaping of your values and how that creates the worldview and is largely shaped by your experiences.
Yeah,
right.
That's why I think Peterson has caught on for so many people. He's like, it comes at you unexpectedly, and then you go, oh, these are all the things that I think this I identify with this worldview. This is my belief system now.
Yeah.
You know, and guys who are not used to dealing with their emotional life, because most American men are not, kind of get it. It's like when I converted to Christianity, I was hardcore. Like, it's not that I'm not a hardcore Christian at this point, but I was like, it's like the new libertarians are always the most like jihadist, you know, and like the new people who are into politics. That's why I think partly the discussion sucks right now about everything is because people got interested in politics in 2016.
Yeah.
And so they're all new and they're all like, they don't know how to research. They don't know how to think. They don't know the discussions that we've all figured out over the past 10 years or 50 years.
Well, it's tough to react to Trump.
Right.
Right. I mean, it is.
Yeah, for real.
So, I feel that was...
So, for you, though, is that we keep talking about values, but then at the beginning, we said we were going to talk about morals.
Ooh, I thought the word was values that Chris chose. Either way.
Well, Chris started talking about values.
Explain the difference.
Well, I'm just trying to think if my value system dictates where I derive my morals from. For me.
Okay.
I'm wondering, like, the only reason I'm saying this is because I'm wondering if that's... Not the way it actually works.
Oh, I don't know.
If I'm getting something mixed up.
No. I'm not sure I delineate the difference between values and morals.
So I had to Google it.
I'm probably just interchanging. Are there differences?
Thanks to...
Help me, Google.
Difference between morals and values.net. it's literally called difference between .net. Difference between morals and values. Morals and values are a... part of a behavioral aspect of a person. Moral is a system of beliefs that is taught for deciding good or bad, whereas values are personal beliefs or something that comes from within. Mm. These are emotionally related for deciding what is right or wrong. So the morals are the system.
Come from a system.
Come from a system, whereas values are more personal.
Oh, see, that makes sense. Yeah. That totally makes sense to me.
Some YouTube watcher says we're clickbaiting motherfuckers. No, we've just been doing this for 2 hours. So if you go back to the beginning, it's exactly what we said we were going to do, bruh. So once we end, go back and you're going to watch at the beginning. So what about ethics? What's versus ethics? Yeah, well, let's check that out.
See, I guess I don't really think
ethics,
about...
Ethics are moral values in action.
In action.
In action.
Okay. Yeah, that makes don't sense you report too. Us for terrorism. I will find you, I will hunt you down, and I will report you to Hillary Clinton, telling her that you'd like to make love to her.
Gross. That's, that's how Trump made the deal.
So, any other conversation on this topic?
I guess that my big thing was is that I went through this whole thing thinking about just morals. I've never really thought about my personal value system. I've always thought about where I derive the system of beliefs that I have that I derive the right. moral code from.
Yeah.
So that, I mean,
I think that's equally important.
Yeah.
If so not, I was basically just sitting here learning the whole time.
Because I think there are systemic beliefs that we are handed down from our parents or and I think sometimes people don't challenge that and my parents are the ultimate authority in life. Mm-hmm. And so therefore they know best. And so I'm just an anti-authoritarian type person. So the second I could think critically at 8 years old, I was like, why do you think that, you dummy? My mom's like, don't call me a dummy. And so.
All right, dummy.
So I've just always been a questioning person about every single thing. And so I don't understand people who just kind of accept the same things their parents accept. By and large, as it has taken me 20 years to kind of get to the place where, by and large, I really kind of think all the things that my parents taught me. But I had to work it out for myself.
Right.
And I guess I don't understand people that don't have that same thing.
That same journey that they go through. Yeah. Where I derive my own personal morals from, I read a lot of Stoicism literature. So,
okay. So where that came from?
It was just a natural habit whenever someone mentions Stoicism. Right. So,
you do have that fuckboy fade.
Yeah, that's new this time.
You know who's awesome? Tucker Max.
This guy over here.
Yeah,
but seriously, though, Ryan Holiday and Stephen Hanselman.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever heard of those two authors.
Ryan Holiday, yeah.
Okay. So anyone who's listening, I definitely suggest you check them out.
Ego is the Enemy or The Obstacle is the Way. Really,
yeah,
Obstacle is the Way is a really good book.
Ego is the Enemy is really good, too.
His book about Hulk Hogan and Gawker is supposed to be really good, too.
I had no idea that he had a book about Hulk Hogan.
Yeah. It's his first non-Stoicism-type book.
Okay.
And he basically spent a couple of years researching the fall of Gawker and Peter Thiel funding Hulk Hogan and the come down on that.
Huh. Interesting.
So just real quick, I want to kind of I put something up on the Facebook page because here's the thing about the Facebook page. I've just put Stone in charge and a couple other people in charge of the social media.
You guys blew up this week.
Dude, Stone posted one thing with Tucker Carlson where this one woman said we should change the name of the mail because mail carriers inherently have mail in them. And it got 3 million impressions and 1.2 million video views. And it got us 2,000 new likes, and then I shit posted the immigration stuff so hard yesterday that I lost us 500. But the Facebook page is basically a trash can, and so I basically posted today hey, if you actually want intelligent conversation and talk and facts, you need to listen to our podcast because you're not going to get it here because the market wants shit posting. They want memes, so we give them memes. So don't it's the Facebook page.
Stone provides.
We've become cancer, okay? We've become liberty cancer, and I regret it, but you just get to a certain point that is so big in terms of likes and reach that you just turn into, the newspaper comment section no matter what you post. And, if you post a 14 Reasons Immigration is Good by Cato, it gets 1,000 people see it, but then you post, some Karl Marx's Hungry meme and it gets 2 million people seeing it. And so it grieves me that people want trash, but so it's not that we feed trash, but There's a lot of memes on there.
Harry and James Neese were talking about that in a video chat yesterday.
Yeah.
And it was, Harry had some really funny things to say about it.
If I ever see Harry again, I will ask him about
it. Yep, you should.
I think he'll be here tomorrow.
I'm not going to say anything about what he said because I'm going to hold him to it.
Say it for the air.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, so the hope, I've never had anybody, and if you are a listener who found us through the Facebook page, please tell me, but I've never had anybody say that they listened because of the Facebook page, but I guess we just keep trying for reach in case somebody might find us because of that, but...
How many people that like, of the 90,000 people that like that Facebook page, do you think actually know it's a podcast?
1% maybe, if that. Less than 1,000 people for sure. You know, and so it's like, I just don't even care about it because it doesn't really do much for the main product, which is this. So it's just like, maybe just Stone, here, have a title. Do something. So if you're new to the podcast, if you actually took advice from that post and listened, like, here are the things, here are the 10 principles of We Are Libertarians, the things that we value. And this is an article that I'll put in the show notes, so you can read through it. I won't go through all of it. But, you know, first and foremost, when we're examining current events and talking about stuff, we ask, what is best for liberty? So I don't look at Donald Trump and go, what is best for Donald Trump? What is best for Republicans? What is best for me personally? I go, what is best for liberty? Plain and simple. And liberty is defined by the key concepts of libertarianism by David Bowes: individualism, individual rights, spontaneous order, limited governments, free markets, the virtue of production, the natural harmony of interest, and peace. Number two, all contributions towards moving society in this direction are valued. So I tease anarchists, but I value anarchists. I think they provide a very valuable service to the liberty movement by being its conscience and constantly pushing people towards more libertarian beliefs. Just as I value Republican libertarians who believe that, you know, Rand Paul and Thomas Massey are valued members of the libertarian movement. Like, I just don't, I'm trying to be agnostic and say that if you're trying to do something for libertarianism, then it's good. Number three, the golden rule is the foundational principle of a libertarian society. Now, this gets argued a lot because it's religious and there's a lot of atheists in the libertarian movement. But the reason I say this is because the golden rule teaches that you treat others as you'd like to be treated. And it's not necessarily a selfish thing. It's that you're treating other people in the way that you want to be treated. Maybe not the way that you treat yourself, because some of you treat yourselves like trash cans. But it is putting people first. It's about being empathetic towards people. And so what liberty and libertarianism and the way that it structures society through government inherently is good for people. And it values the individual and their right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of property and happiness. So that's why it's on there. Government exists and politics will not cease in our lifetime. So politics will always be with us. We will probably always have government. And so I don't spend a lot of time talking about the distant utopian future, although we do sometimes. But I use it as a standard for us to move directionally. I'm not a person who just thinks that this is the libertarian world. There are a lot of people who do that, like Roger Paxton at Lava Flow, and I invite you to listen to them. We Are Libertarians serves as an entry point for the libertarian movement. We're a safe show for you to share with your friends and family. We're not going to scare them with a lot of conspiracy talk or a lot of, you know, we like when we talk about the borders tomorrow. Yeah, I will explain open borders and why it is the libertarian option, but I will also give you other frameworks. I will give you a different view so people don't walk away going, oh my gosh, all libertarians believe this one thing. We believe in presenting all sides of an issue to let the listener or reader make up their minds. I try really hard to tell you what everybody believes so you can understand the issue fully. I don't know why I put these in Roman numerals because I don't know what those mean. this is number seven. Achieving liberty is a never-ending fight, and libertarians must invest in future generations. So we often forget that liberty is a... The tree of liberty must be refreshed with the blood of patriots, and that means that every generation must struggle to learn liberty for itself and how to apply it in its time, and we don't do a good job of that. Every individual can make societal change. It's very easy to change the world if you try hard enough. You know, someone like Elizabeth Warren wrote a paper. Bernie Sanders, not Bernie Sanders, Barney Frank adopted it, made it famous. She ran for Senate, and now she's a front runner for a president. 10 years ago, nobody knew who she was. It's very easy in this society to become a big fish if you just keep working. We embrace complexity and reject tribalism. Some things are just not simple. Life is not simple, and things are complex. And so we can't just break it down into these binary choices. It's very stupid. And we treat modern politics with all of the irreverence modern politics deserves. I think you have to have a sense of humor. And I think that you should be a little sarcastic and a little, you should just have fun in life. I work for a comedy show, too. I'm a joke writer by day. So I just generally think that most of what everybody talks about is absurd, and we should just look at it that way. So more, if you want to read all the document, I'll put that in the show notes. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Thank you to Matt and to Dakota. Let's end with your final thoughts. Final thoughts for this episode, Matt?
Oh, man. So we covered a lot of territory, yet at the same time, I'm not sure we really conquered anything.
I know. I was sitting here thinking about it when he was going through the list, and I'm like...
You know, I think it's really... the part I come away with and I struggle with, and it's hard to... you know, say it and not sound, you know, elitist or something like that, right? Is like, I just, there's the masses of people out there, right? And it, you know, you talk about like everybody's following the crowd and, you know, Peterson's going through like the, you know, if he was in Nazi Germany, yeah, he could see himself and being one of the people who would, you know, help perpetrate the Nazi cause, and look what happened in real life. It happened, right? I mean, and so the ability to get, like, truly stand for values that, or morals that you think are going to bring you into making the decisions that I think you hope and dream to be able to do, I think it's hard work. And yeah, if totally there's anything agree. That I take away from, you know, spending an ounce of time on Facebook or looking at the entirety of human history, most people don't put in the hard work.
Right.
Right. And I'm not saying I'm there. Right. I but I also don't want to impose the fact that, like, everybody, you know, just to leap to the fact that everybody's lazy or, you know,
some people
lacks
don't,
values.
Some people
or
just don't have the goods.
You know, go yeah. that the value to go along to get along is what you know, what drives most people, right? And I struggle with that, and that's disheartening. And I periodically, you know, live my own life and withdraw versus like want to go out and do something about it, and it's right. tough. And so this episode didn't help me solve any of those problems. So okay. screw you, man.
I hope I made more for you.
You know,
the goal was not to solve a problem. You problem solvers, you sometimes it's about the journey. It's about the discussion.
I if anything, I probably enjoy the journey too much, and yeah. I don't actually accomplish anything. I think that's I'm an INTP. Yeah. So
yeah, you're all in your head.
All up in the head. Man, it's no good.
I need to look up mine now.
Yeah, I'm really disappointed in you, Dakota.
It's almost as bad as being an INFJ. Oh, just in the clouds all day.
My ex was an INFJ. Yeah.
Ooh, yeah. I've dated a lot of INFJs.
But now I have an ISTJ.
See, that's...
That's hard.
See,
but she's awesome. But.
I would prefer that because they're more systemic, and I need that. I need someone to organize
totally systemic, structured,
yep.
duty...
Yep.
Right? Like, you know, she would...
Duty means poop.
She would kill people in a war.
Yeah. Right. Right.
So,
I would just, like, if I were in a war, I'd sit there and, oh, but what about the generational trauma?
Yeah.
Stupid ENFJ brain.
Yeah. Yeah. So, anyway, I don't have many great final thoughts here for you, Chris. I've had a fun time. I'm glad to finally, after I think we've been trying to arrange... coming out here for
a year, long time. At least a year.
And so thanks for having me. And
the last time you were supposed to be here, it was I canceled the episode because of the incident.
The incident, so. I was going to be here.
Right, that was October.
And we almost still did the show.
I was like, and then that day I was like, no.
Still canceled me.
Yeah, I'm an ISTP.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And my wife. Okay. My wife is an ISFJ.
Oh, that's. I don't know much about either of those.
Yep.
Weirdos.
All right, Dakota. Final thoughts?
Let's see. My final thoughts is I guess I'm still on a journey to try to figure out where exactly I derive my own morals from. I'm still trying to do a lot of reading, keep myself open to those ideas. I try to do a good job, but I like the journey. You know, the journey is the most fun part because you're reading
just
constantly,
a small
learning.
Town girl,
yeah,
living in a lonely world. I love Journey too.
Yep, and I'm about to leave here and take the midnight train. No, but I guess that my real final thoughts are, of course, check out Boss Hog Liberty on Facebook, at Liberty_Boss on Twitter.
If you didn't say this, if you didn't, could you imagine what happens if you didn't shamelessly plug?
Dude, it's rubbed off on me so much. Right. I just do it anyway.
He will feed you to his Liberty Gators. Thing about Jeremiah is he rules Henry County with an iron fist, and he's got these gators in his pool that he feeds dissidents to.
My boss has found out about Boss Hog of Liberty.
Really?
So now every time that he calls me on the phone, he's like 63. He just says, "Hey, is this the Boss Hog of Liberty?"
And he laughs and laughs.
Oh, he does. Yep.
Oh, boomers.
Yep. He wants to come on the show.
Do it.
Really bad. Every time he says, "I haven't gotten my invitation yet," and I just say, "Dave, let my people get in contact with your people."
Isn't it funny how when you become moderately successful and roughly 500 people listen to your show, they're like, "You gonna have me on? Yeah, it's so funny. Like, but then there's a point where you get so big that people just think he'll never. Like, it's wall's not there yet. It doesn't happen as much as it used to. Like when you're in like that. Lower to bottom middle range, like that's when people really ask to come on your show. But then if you get kind of a bigger podcast, or if you're like the day job big, people just go, "There's no way."
Yeah.
And so they just don't even ask.
I don't know, because I was pretty honored to whenever you first asked me to come on here. I was like, "Whoa."
As you should be.
I'm going on to We Are Libertarians. There's like a bunch of people that listen to that.
Right. And nothing changed in your life at all, did it?
Nope, it didn't.
No, not at all. Not a bit.
I have a podcast of my own since then. Right. I don't know how that's going.
The review is next week. And I hope you
the yearly review.
Schedule your therapy session. It's going to be rough. All right, kids. Nothing for me. I just thank you for being here, and I appreciate you guys listening. Love for you to get that bonus content, $5. That's all it takes. Once a month, that helps support We Are Libertarians. I'm going to Porkfest on Thursday, and then I'm going to the National Libertarian Convention.
I'm sorry.
I'm going to the Podcast Movement Conference. I'm doing a lot of traveling, and so all of those dollars help go towards those trips, help gather content and find out what's really happening on the ground with the anarchists and then with the libertarians, and I will report back to you. The podcast movement stuff is going to be a lot of fun because I'm going to find all kinds of cool new tactics and technology, and I'll find all kinds of fun ways to dazzle you with this mediocre voice of mine. So please become a Patreon subscriber. It really helps. Frankly, I spend a ton of time on this. I've spent tens of thousands of dollars on this, and it's nice to finally be paid back some of that money and pay down some of the debt that I acquired buying all of this phony baloney equipment. And that's partly what it goes to. Part of it goes just to pure operations. It costs hundreds of dollars a month to run We Are Libertarians. And if I didn't have your donations at Patreon, I couldn't afford to do this anymore. And so if you would miss us if we were gone, if you get something out of this podcast, if this impacts your thinking in any way, then I invite you to please go to WeAreLibertarians.com and become a monthly subscriber at Patreon.com. I will thank you long time. So Until then, yes, Christy's right. The Amazon wish list will grow after Philadelphia, I am sure. Also, weirdlibertarians.com. All right, thanks, guys, for joining us, and we will see you tomorrow night.